Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young. Coming up, Hamas claims responsibility for a suicide attack, but says it will return to a ceasefire. We'll have a live report from Israel.
Also, we're in the first job loss recovery since the Depression, but is there reason for optimism?
It takes one company in each industry to step up and say, hey, you know, it's time to grow and expand, and every other company's going to have to follow, otherwise they'll lose their market share. So I think there's reasons to be optimistic here.
Also, what it's like to live with new cancer treatments.
There are some people who started taking the drug before I did who have been taking it for 3 years, but for me it only worked for 18 months. And I was once again looking at death in a year.
These stories and more coming up Here and Now.
The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Ann Bozell. An American soldier was killed and two wounded today in a bomb attack in the town of Ramadi, about 60 miles west of Baghdad. A U.S. military spokeswoman says three synchronized bombs blew up near a convoy on the outskirts of town. Secretary of State Colin Powell says suicide attacks are a major roadblock to peace in the Middle East.
We will never get to the peace that we all seek. We will never get there as long as people continue to participate in terrorist activities, and we see the response to terrorist activities which are necessary for self-defense.
Powell spoke in Washington hours after two suicide bombers struck in separate attacks in the West Bank and Israel, killing two Israelis and wounding more than a dozen. The BBC's James Rogers has details.
The two attacks add up to the most serious act of violence against Israelis since the Palestinian militant groups declared a three-month truce at the end of June. The Al-Aqsa Brigades, an armed offshoot of the Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat's Fatah movement, say they sent the bomber who struck at a supermarket in Rosh Ha'in near Tel Aviv. Hamas's military wing say they carried out the attack near the Jewish settlement of Ariel in the West Bank. The killings threaten further the uneasy calm in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. The Israeli government say the attacks demonstrate the need to dismantle what they call the Palestinian terrorist infrastructure.
The BBC's James Rogers reporting from Jerusalem. Israel says it will postpone the release of dozens of Palestinian prisoners. Temperatures shot above 100 degrees for another day today in southern Europe as the continent continues to swelter in a record-breaking heat wave. European power companies are beginning to feel the crunch as demand for electricity surges. Jerome Sokolowski has that story from Madrid.
The French power company is asking people to use less electricity after having to close power plants relying on rivers for cooling water. Plants have also been shut down in Germany and Italy. In Spain, a forest fire that killed five people near Barcelona is spreading and nearing another that appears to have been ignited by arsonists. It's the second deadliest summer in terms of heat-related fatalities in Spain, and the heat is simply unbearable for northern Europeans. Police in Paris reduced speed limits and asked people to leave their cars at home. And in Germany, a major confectioner suspended delivery of chocolate eggs because they were melting. For NPR News, I'm Jerome Sokolowski.
California election officials are still reviewing the list of candidates who have filed in the October 7th recall election of Governor Gray Davis. More than 100 names have been certified so far. A final list is expected by tomorrow night. Stocks are trading higher on Wall Street. The Dow is up 10 points to 92.27. The Nasdaq is up 5 to 16.67. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, security experts say a worm began spreading rapidly through the Internet yesterday, infecting computers inside universities, businesses, and homes. It knocked many computers offline, but did not appear to delete files or cause any permanent damage. The infection exploits a flaw in Microsoft's Windows software. It was first noticed yesterday in the U.S., but has now spread across Europe and Asia. Federal Reserve policymakers are meeting in Washington today, although most analysts don't expect the Fed to take any action. The Federal Open Market Committee is expected to leave interest rates at their current 1% level. NPR's Jack Spear reports.
If the private economists are correct, short-term interest rates, already at their lowest levels in 45 years, have now fallen just about as far as they're going to in the current easing cycle that began in January of 2001. What economists will be paying close attention to today is the statement issued at the conclusion of the Fed's closed-door session. After cutting interest rates by a quarter point in June, the Federal Open Market Committee said it was still worried about the possibility of deflation, a condition where falling prices prompts consumers and businesses to hold off on buying as they wait for prices to fall even further. However, in recent weeks, there have been tentative signs both groups are spending. The bond market is also likely to react to today's meeting. There was some disappointment by bond traders following the June Fed meeting because the Fed didn't cut rates more aggressively. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
Contract talks are scheduled to resume today between Verizon and its two unions. Negotiators took a three-day break over the weekend. The contracts expired more than a week ago. I'm Ann Bozell, NPR News in Washington.
The NPR Shop introduces All Songs Considered 3, the newest compilation of music heard on All Things Considered at npr.org.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Two Palestinian suicide bombers have killed two Israelis and injured at least a dozen. Hamas took credit for an attack at a bus stop near a Jewish settlement on the West Bank, and the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade, linked to Yasser Arafat's Fatah movement, took responsibility for an attack at a strip mall near Tel Aviv. So much for the ceasefire reached between Israel and Palestinian militants June 29th. But hold on. As so often in the Middle East, it may not be quite that simple. Joining us on the line now is Nicole Gawet, staff writer for the Christian Science Monitor. She joins us on the line from Jerusalem. Welcome, Nicole.
Thank you.
Well, Nicole, let's talk about Hamas first, a suicide attack on the West Bank. But soon after, the group said it would return right away to a state of ceasefire. What are we to make of that?
Yeah, they seem to want to be members of the Have It Both Ways Club. They have said that this attack was in response to a raid the Israeli army conducted on Friday in which two Hamas members and two civilians died. That was also the reason cited by the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade for their attack within Israel proper. At the time on Friday, Hamas said that they would answer that army raid, but that they would still hold to the truce.
So this was retaliation for what had happened, but does that suggest that more of this will happen or that they really will pull back now?
Well, they argue that they are just responding to Israeli violations of the ceasefire with their own similar violations, but that they will stick to the ceasefire as long as Israel does. This has been a little problematic because, strictly speaking, the ceasefire is unilateral. It's only Palestinian. Hamas, Islamic Jihad, and the Fatah movement have agreed to stop attacks, but Israel was not party to this agreement.
And I see. How has Israel reacted to all this?
Well, very angrily. And they have insisted that the Palestinian Authority crack down on the militant groups once again, which is a little difficult as they're just not in a position to do that. They're not strong enough yet and have tried to compromise with this ceasefire. They have threatened the Palestinians with they've come out with a veiled threat about withdrawing from the roadmap by saying that the Palestinians will not see any sort of state until there is a crackdown on militants.
Something of an inherent contradiction, is there not? Israel says the Palestinian Authority must crack down, but the Palestinian Authority has been decimated and diminished in the past 2 years by its conflict with Israel and may not be capable of doing that, right?
That's right. It's not. And that's the reason Israel is given for its continued pursuit of militants in spite of the ceasefire. And so you have a very unfortunate dynamic where the PA can't crack down on the militants right now. Israel continues to do so while the militants see themselves as, you know, holding back. And so this, in some respects, was only a matter of time.
So will Israel hold back now, though? There is some indication that they will not do the sort of whole-scale retaliation that they've done in the past. Just about 30 seconds left, Nicole.
I believe they will. I mean, they are reserving the right to respond to any situation that the Palestinian Authority isn't cracking down on, that is ticking bombs, people, militants they see who perhaps are about to conduct an attack.
But you don't expect a full-scale retaliation from Israel?
We don't. We do not.
Yeah. Well, Nicole Gawet, thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Nicole Gawet is a staff writer for the Christian Science Monitor. She joined us from Jerusalem.
President Bush sits down with his top economic advisors in Crawford, Texas tomorrow, and the heat will be on. The temperature in Crawford has been well over 100, and you can add to that the soaring deficit and rising jobless rate. Joining us from Crawford, Texas to talk about tomorrow's meeting is Wall Street Journal reporter Greg Hitt. Greg, how hot is it?
It's hot. It's steaming on the asphalt outside here.
Yeah, and inside this meeting tomorrow, apparently there's going to be a sense of urgency. Your educated guess, how important is this meeting to the president and his advisors?
I think it's very important. He has to take stock of the economy and also take stock of his political calendar. And right now there's an intersection of the two that's troubling for the president and his top advisors at the White House and on his campaign.
What do analysts tell you? Can this economy be fixed before Election Day?
The answer is yes, but there may not be much that he can do as president to significantly alter the course of the economy between now and Election Day. He's already had 3 tax cuts in each year of his presidency. And if he chose to do that again, it's very unlikely that the benefits of that tax cut would feed into the economy in time to produce a significant amount of job growth.
Right. And that is the issue, is it not, job growth?
Yes. The economy has been picking up. It percolated along at about a 2.4 or so percent rate in the second quarter. But the problem is that that is not strong enough to produce a significant number of new jobs.
Right.
And he's had a lot of job loss since he took office.
As you write, the U.S. economy has lost more than 2 million jobs since Mr. Bush took office, and the jobless rate in June reached a 9-year high of 6.4.
Right.
It eased a little bit, but as you write, it's because people just stopped looking for jobs. It's not as if they got them. They just have given up.
That's what worries the White House, is that if there were more workers in the workforce actually looking for jobs, the unemployment rate would actually be much higher.
Well, we're going to talk more about joblessness in just a moment, but there's other issues. The feds have already cut short-term interest rates to a 45-year low.
Right.
Doesn't feel like there's anywhere to go.
He really is handcuffed in a way. He can't expect the Fed to do too much more. They pretty much have tapped out monetary policy.
Mm. Well, tell me this. Who is expected to attend the meeting, and who, in your opinion, is notably missing?
I think everybody will be there from the administration, secretaries of Commerce and Treasury, Mr. Bush's top economic team within the White House. Who's not there? Right now, they're not drawing on some outside help. Last year, they called in business leaders to meet with the president, and that actually produced some ideas like the dividend cut that they enacted this last year. This year, it's a more insular gathering. He's not getting a lot of outside input at this point.
Well, it seems as if the president is going to be taking a lot of hits on the economy from the Democratic candidates for president, but he's also going to be taking hits from his own party, the conservative right. There's a group we've read about recently that wants him to make even more tax cuts.
That's right. He faces sort of cross-cutting winds on the fiscal front for him. Some members of his party want more tax cuts. Other members of the party want him to stop cutting taxes and to start finding ways to reduce the deficit, which is at a record high.
Well, Greg, we know a lot of characters have gathered outside the president's ranch there in Crawford. There's a group that's got an inflatable White House. They say the White House is for sale. There's a man who's ridden cross-country on a horse to draw attention to world hunger. There's just all sorts of people. But what about inside this meeting? If no policy is made tomorrow, what about just the impression that the president is concerned about jobs?
Very important politically for the president every time he can to show that he cares about the pocketbook concerns of voters.
Mm. Well, Greg, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Stay cool.
Greg, I'll try.
Greg Hitt, a reporter with the Wall Street Journal, speaking to us from Crawford, Texas.
Well, as we just heard, President Bush will meet with his top economic pundits and prognosticators tomorrow amid an ongoing economic recovery, 2.4% growth in the second quarter. That should be good news. But since the last recession officially ended way back in November 2001, 2.7 million jobs have disappeared. We're not in a jobless recovery like in the early 1990s. We're in a very unusual job loss recovery. And Mark Zandi is here to discuss it. He's chief economist at economy.com. And welcome, Mark.
Good afternoon. It's good to be with you.
Mark, job loss recovery, is that a new economic term?
It is. It's a play on how we described what happened to us a decade ago in the jobless recovery. We're in a period of no job growth. Currently, we're in a period of actually losing jobs.
So has anything like this ever happened before in the economy?
Well, you have to go all the way back to the Great Depression. There hasn't been a time since the Depression that we've experienced this length of job losses.
Wow. So economists must be kind of fascinated by this almost in an academic sense.
Well, only in an academic sense. Yeah. Clearly, it represents a lot of pain and suffering.
Sure does. Are job losses in all industries across the board, Mark?
It is very broad-based across most industries, all of manufacturing, wholesaling, big parts of retailing, of course, transportation and airlines, investment banking, and now state governments are laying off. It's also evident across many occupations and in most parts of the country, from Boston to the Bay Area of California, we're seeing job losses.
Can you boil down the reason for it?
Well, the principal reason is that the economy is growing very slowly. Demand and production are growing, but not quickly enough to induce businesses to hire more aggressively. Moreover, businesses are working very hard to raise their productivity. They're trying to keep their costs down. And because of those strong productivity gains, they just don't need as many people working. And that's why we're seeing these job losses.
Yeah. Mark, what's caused this high productivity?
Well, there's a great deal of debate, but there are a number of factors that I think everyone seems to agree on. One is the rapid pace of technological change. That's been something we've seen for much of the past decade and doesn't seem to be slowing. Mm. The other factor is very severe competitive pressures. Businesses can't raise prices for their goods and services because of global competition, so they have to work very, very hard at trying to reduce their costs and raise productivity. And then third, businesses are still reaping the benefit of all the investments they made in and around the boom times of Y2K. There was a lot of investing in computer hardware, software, telecommunications equipment, and businesses are still figuring out ways to use that equipment more effectively and thus keep productivity high and thus that weighs on job growth.
Yeah, well, if technology and workers overseas are replacing workers, human workers, why should that situation change anytime in the future?
There are reasons to be optimistic here.
Oh.
We are getting some tax cuts. Interest rates are low.
Tax cuts, why would that make a difference?
Well, that's going to lift demand. We're going to see people go out and spend more. In fact, the vehicle sales have picked up a bit, and the low rates are continuing to juice up the housing markets and refinancing markets, and that provides a lot of cash to households. And the hope is that they'll pick up enough to convince businesses that they need to go out and start hiring a few people. And if they do that, then this very fragile recovery will then turn into a more sustained economic rebound.
So you're not against ending our conversation on the job loss recovery on an optimistic note? You think things could get better?
And I think there's every reason to be optimistic. Clearly, there are a lot of risks out there, but I think at this point, there's more reasons to be optimistic than pessimistic. And I think it just takes one company in each industry to step up and say, hey, you know, it's time to grow and expand, and every other company is going to have to follow, otherwise they'll lose their market share. So I think there's reasons to be optimistic here.
Well, dark times for a lot of families in this country. Maybe it's not the worst thing to have a conversation about the economy that doesn't end on a completely sour note. Mark Zandi, thank you very much for joining us.
It was a pleasure.
Mark Zandi is chief economist at economy.com.
Just ahead, a new generation of cancer treatment drugs may be the real thing, but it's still tough to be the human guinea pig.
And later in the show, the musical mecca that is Newport.
There's more coming up here and now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
An exciting new drug is showing great promise in the treatment of cancer patients. How many times have you heard that one? But it's true. There is a new generation of cancer drugs. They're much more specific for tumors than the older drugs. Doctors call them targeted therapies, and many of them are raising hopes. But for people with cancer, that hope comes along with a dose of uncertainty. Judy Foreman is Here and Now's regular health columnist. Judy, welcome once again.
Thank you.
We want to talk to you in a moment, but first, we want to meet Dean Gournonier. He's someone who's had firsthand experience with both the hope and the heartbreak of these new cancer drugs. Dean, welcome.
Glad to be here.
You are 54 years old, a father of three, a fitness buff, I can see. But how did you find out that you also had cancer?
Well, I went to my doctor for acid indigestion. It took a few weeks to get tests set up. It was several days after Christmas. I went in and had an ultrasound, and they discovered a large tumor. And within a week, I was being operated on. It was diagnosed as gastrointestinal stromal tumor, which is a kind of malignant cancer. They thought they'd gotten all of the tumor and left clean margins, as the doctors say. Mm. But 6 months later, it came back. It had spread to my liver, and I was looking at having about a year to live. I had a chemoembolization, which is a not very pleasant chemical treatment, didn't work. And in May of 2000, I was waiting to die, and I got on to a dosage test for a new drug called Gleevec,
right. One
of the targeted miracle drugs. It was the only one at the time.
And how did you feel about taking that, knowing it was experimental?
At that point, it was a dosage test, and so it had already been proved to be reasonably effective in the first 50 to 60 patients who had taken it, next to no significant side effects, so it was pretty safe. And it worked.
For a time.
For a while, yes.
Because?
Well, cancer mutates, or most cancers mutate, and mine was no exception. There are some people who started taking the drug before I did who have been taking it for 3 years, but for me it only worked for 18 months. And just before Christmas of last year, I found out that the liver tumors had started to grow again. And I was once again looking at death in a year, probably a year. But I got into a first stage, phase one dosage test of a new drug called Sugen, or it doesn't have a name yet. It's too new to have a name. Formerly made by a company called Sugen. And
is this the SU-11248?
Yeah, that's right.
Yes, well known among cancer patients.
It is, in fact.
So I just want to hold you up there for a second, because Judy, bringing you back in this conversation, this seems to be the roller coaster that many patients get on when they take these miraculous, but again, you know, they don't often work, experimental drugs.
Yeah, that's right. It's really tough for patients because their backs are against the wall. I mean, the new drug holds the promise of at least an extended life, but it also can have side effects. And often doctors really don't know what to tell patients in terms of what to expect on the plus side and the minus side.
And just tell us briefly, how are they different from the older drugs?
These are called targeted therapies, as you said, and they're aimed at very tiny molecules, proteins, in and on the surface of cells. That some of these proteins make cells grow too fast or too uncontrollably. Some of them have other ways of controlling cell division. And these are molecules, or the drugs are aimed at these specific molecules, so they will only get that tumor, in theory, and not the surrounding cells. Like with Dean's kind of cancer, there's a particular molecule that Gleevec is aimed at, and it's very specific. So that's why it has so few side effects.
Right. And getting back to your story, Dean, you went from Gleevec to the SU-11248. How is that doing?
I'm still alive. Yes. I feel it works better than Gleevec. Gleevec left me with feeling nauseous twice a day when I took the pills and tired all the time. And this drug has, so far, no side effects. I'm pretty much a poster child for the drug.
Well, what is it about? Is it about buying time with this drug until yet another drug comes? You know, what is your sense of how long this will
drug,
last?
This drug, I don't know. I don't expect it to last forever. I expect the cancer will mutate again, and I will be alive as long as the doctors keep one step ahead of the tumors. That's the nature of the path I'm on.
Right. Judy, what do patients need to know when they're making these decisions? Because, as Dean well knows, it is your decision.
It is, but there's almost no way to know as much as the doctors know, and they don't even know enough. I mean, it's like taking a crash course in oncology when you're faced with these situations. But there are some questions that you can learn to ask. One of them that's important is, you know, if a doctor says this works great, you can say, well, is this a statistical finding, or did this really translate into more months or years of life? And so, you know, you got to ask if you're the person, well, you know, I might get 2 months, I might get no months, I might get 10 months. What will this mean for me?
And Dean, I suppose another question is about quality of life.
Yes.
Length of life is one thing, but quality.
Some drugs have side effects which, though they don't kill you right away, make living not very pleasant. To be constantly nauseous or always exhausted, one might decide that that's not what one wants.
Right. If, you know, is 5 months a lot or a little? I mean, it's wonderful and precious if you can spend it with your grandchildren or in your garden or whatever. It's an awful long time if you're going to be in the ICU and miserable the whole time.
Mm. Well, Dean, as someone who's been through it, as you said, the doctor's main goal is to keep one step ahead of the tumors. They may not be thinking of the patients. What would you recommend to make your procedure better? And what would you tell patients to think about if they, you know, have 2 seconds to think about making a decision?
The one thing that you do learn going through this process is that unless your physician is someone who is the very peak of the profession and knows about your particular kind of cancer, you're going to know more about it than they do. If you've done any kind of research at all, and the people that live longest have done the research, and you owe it to yourself to do it, you ought to get on the web. There's usually support groups for every single kind of cancer. Find out, talk to people, what experiences they've had. Find the best doctors, get the best treatment, because it's only with the best treatment that you have a shot.
Well, Dean, thanks to you, others following in your footsteps, and we know there are others, will now know more. Thank you so much.
Glad to be here.
Well, glad you are here and present. Thank you. Dean Gordonier is a cancer patient, and Judy Foreman wrote about Dean in today's syndicated column. To read more, visit our website, here-now.org.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, we'll talk to the American Bar Association's first black president about lawyer-client confidentiality in a post-terrorism, post-Enron world.
Also, for almost 50 years, some of the best musicians anywhere have performed at the Newport Jazz and Folk Festival. We speak to George Wein, the man who started it all.
I wanted Bing Crosby to sing at my festival. I tried to get him, but I didn't. So I would say that's the one artist that I wanted to have.
these stories coming up here and now.
I'm Marianne Nichols. A bomb attack in Iraq this morning has left one American soldier dead. Another U.S. soldier died in a traffic accident, and another soldier apparently died in his sleep at a U.S. base in Ramadi. And north of Baghdad, U.S. forces are keeping people away from a burst oil pipeline. Reporter Lourdes Navarro has more.
Flames 200 feet high in the air are spewing out of a burst oil pipeline near Al-Taji, 12 miles north of Baghdad. American forces at the scene crouched in firing positions, keeping journalists at bay. It's not clear if the fire is the work of saboteurs. Meanwhile, Iraq's interim government says plans to reopen Basra's airport in the south will go ahead by the end of the month. It says it has already authorized planned flights by at least six foreign carriers. The current president of the U.S.-picked governing council says the resumption of flights will be a big step forward to opening Iraq to the world. Lourdes Navarro, Baghdad.
Liberian rebels are rejecting the rule of President Moses Blah, the man pegged by outgoing President Charles Taylor to take over after he stepped down yesterday. A spokesman says rebel groups will maintain a ceasefire for now, but will not cooperate with Blah's government. Rebels controlling Monrovia's port say they'll turn over control when more peacekeeping forces arrive. The heat wave that has fanned wildfires and killed dozens of people continues in Europe. In France, power company officials have asked people to use less electricity. In Italy, meteorologists say the city of Turin hit 107 degrees Monday, hotter than any day in the last 250 years. At least 45 people have died throughout Europe because of the heat. A massive internet virus spread across the globe today, wreaking havoc on home computers and corporate networks alike. Security officials say the so-called LoveScan virus was part of a coordinated attack on Microsoft's Windows operating system. The virus did not appear to delete any files, but kicked computers offline. Non-Microsoft systems were not affected. The Fox News Network is suing comedian Al Franken for trademark infringement over the phrase fair and balanced on the cover of his upcoming book. Fox says it's been using that as a signature slogan at the network since 1996. Franken's book Lies and Lying Liars Who Tell Them, A Fair and Balanced Look at the Right, is due to be published next month. And on Wall Street at this hour, stocks are generally up. The Dow is up 10 points at 92.27. You're listening to Here and Now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
The American Bar Association today urged the Bush administration to change the rules regarding military tribunals. Lawyer-client relations topped the agenda at the ABA's annual meeting in San Francisco. But while the group is asking the government for more privacy with terrorism suspects, the ABA also passed rules giving members more freedom to break the bond of lawyer-client confidentiality in cases of corporate fraud. Dennis Archer was elected president of the group this week. A former mayor of Detroit, he's the first African-American president in the group's history. We spoke to him earlier and began by asking about what he calls his humble beginnings.
Well, yes, I left the city of Detroit, having been born there, and moved to Cassopolis, Michigan, which is about 187 miles from Detroit. Population 1,500. It was a village, not a city and the like, and we did not have running water. So I took a bath in a metal tub every Saturday night, and when I wanted to go to the bathroom, I went outside, whether it was 90 degrees, hot and sunny, or if it was 20 below wind chill factor.
Started working yourself at the age of eight?
That's correct. First job was a caddy on a golf course. And I did a number of things, from setting pins in a bowling alley and sweeping and then mopping a bakery floor on our one-block-long Main Street, just doing a number of odd jobs to do what my mother and father has always indicated, I was going to go to college.
And it was your wife who recommended you go to law school, which seems brilliant now.
That's the reason why I married her. I've never met a lawyer before in my life, didn't know what lawyers do, never been in a law office.
Right. And I read that there are no numbers kept, but is there a guesstimate as to how many African-American members of the Bar Association there are?
No, but I will tell you that the estimate is the American Bar Association has within its membership about 7% of lawyers of color who belong to the American Bar. Our membership is just over 414,000 members.
Yeah. We understand at one time the ABA used to send people out to check a person's color if they didn't know them so that a person...
Robin, your history is very good, and you're correct. At a time in the 1900s, it was discovered that three then called colored lawyers had applied and was admitted into the American Bar. To make sure that didn't occur again, they changed the applications, and you had to list on the application your ethnicity. And if they didn't recognize a name, they would come to your law office to make sure that you were not a person of color. That did not change until 1943, and the first person of color did not join until about 1948.
Well, let's talk about some of the topics on the agenda at this week's annual meeting. The ABA is considering changes to the moral code, and it's going to recommend ceding some ground on client-lawyer confidences. Can you briefly tell us what the code is now and then what the change is expected to be?
Well, let's talk about reality. Reality is presently in the United States, 42 of the 50 states have Supreme Court rules that allow lawyers to disclose when something occurs that might create a fraud or an injury to someone. So this is not something new.
So you're saying this is the ABA sort of catching up with where many of the states already are?
In essence, that's correct.
Yeah. What kind of exchange can you imagine a lawyer might want to tell someone about? What kind of relationship with a client might you now allow a lawyer to talk about?
Robin, you're the client. You come in and you see me and say, you know, Mr. Archer, here's what I've been thinking about doing. I said, well, Robin, if you do that, you're going to break the law. So you think about it and you come back and say, you know, I'm not going to do that. Mm-hmm. There's nothing for me to say to anybody. But if you said, I'm going to do it anyway, I don't care who gets stuck, et cetera, that then raises the confidentiality aspect that allows a lawyer to share that I have a client. Her name is Robin. I've advised her that she's going to embark upon a course of conduct that's going to hurt maybe her employees, that she's going to raid their pension fund and do something that's totally illegal.
Mm. Well, you know, critics of this change in the ABA code have said it's just snitching on clients. It's going to fundamentally affect the lawyer-client relationship. I'm reading a quote from Roger Crampton, who's a law professor at Cornell. And he also goes on to say it's never going to affect an honest client who's going to an honest lawyer. In other words, it still won't get the bad guys.
Well, here's what you're looking at in reality. A lot of people want to do the right thing, and they want to see whether or not what they want to do is illegal or not. We stop more crimes today by virtue of telling people it's illegal, no, it's wrong, etc.
Well, President Archer, some say the ABA is relaxing its confidentiality rules to stay ahead of government regulation. So let's talk about that regulation for a second. There's the recently passed corporate reform and also the Patriot Act, which disrupts lawyer-client privacy. Your thoughts on both?
What Sarbanes-Oxley would do would cause lawyers to have to do a noisy withdrawal where you publish an effect to the world that we think that somebody in this corporation is doing something wrong. What you segued into happens to be how do you represent enemy combatants that are being held in Guantanamo Bay. If you talk to your client, someone must be in the room and hear everything that you say. That if you talk to your client on the telephone, that there can be somebody and will be somebody listening to everything that is said, that you do not have access to documents and things of that nature that you would typically have. One bar association that represents 11,000 criminal defense lawyers have said, we've told our lawyers don't even represent them because if you do, you engage in what is unethical practice. What the American Bar has before the House of Delegates, is a recommendation that and sets forth parameters under which a lawyer should be able to represent their clients. It is my hope that after this passes, that the administration will make changes. So I remain optimistic.
One last question for you, President Archer. As you well know, the Supreme Court just made a landmark decision upholding certain affirmative actions, and that launched a radio blitz of talk show tirades. I can't tell you how many times I've heard now that this means we can't trust that blacks who hold certain positions are qualified. Are you at all concerned that this same criticism will be directed at you?
No, because, Robin, I think that if you compare my qualifications against those who are currently running to become president or president-elect of our wonderful association, or indeed take a look at the qualifications of the past presidents, not one can match my qualifications. The reality of it is that we just did a Harris poll to assess what people really think about the Supreme Court decision. 70% of the people agreed with Madam Justice O'Connor's opinion. 72% of the people felt it is absolutely important to have diversity in the criminal justice system and the like. So the tirades are those who have been angered because they didn't like the outcome, but they are in the minority. But the minority can be very vocal.
Mr. Archer, thank you very much.
You're quite welcome.
Dennis Archer, just named president of the American Bar Association, speaking to us from the group's annual meeting in San Francisco.
Still to come, Joan Baez to Cassandra Wilson, Bob Dylan to Dave Brubeck. Just about every musician of note has graced the Newport Jazz or Folk Festival. We speak to the man behind it all.
You're listening to Here and Now.
RWQOJMV. No, that doesn't spell anything. That's the alphabetical order for candidates on the California recall ballot. State election officials drew the letters yesterday in a bingo-style lottery. It could be bewildering, all those names, and some voters will also contend with another potential complication, punch card ballots, hanging chads. Florida, ringing any bells? They're back. The controversial ballots were supposed to be phased out in California next year, but several counties haven't managed to trade in their old voting systems. Well, joining us on the line is Ventura County Assistant Registrar Bruce Bradley to get a sense of the electoral mood in his part of California. And welcome, Bruce.
Thank you. Thank you.
Now, these letters that I quoted at the beginning of our segment, RWQOJMV, will those be the alphabetical order of candidates on your ballot in Ventura County, or is it different in every county?
Well, it rotates in the 80 assembly districts throughout the state. The problem is you have more than 80 candidates, so some people will never rotate to the top, but it will be different in every assembly district. There's four assembly districts in Ventura County, so people in this county will see four different series of candidates.
I see. And, of course, if your name is Schwarzenegger, for example, the S could be in the middle of the list or at the end of the list or the top of the list.
And you're going to have to page through card after card to find his name.
How many cards could there be?
Well, in our county, we can get 26 names on a page, so we're looking at about six cards, maybe seven.
How long do you think it's going to take each voter to get out of the booth?
Well, fortunately, there's nothing else to vote for, a couple of measures that nobody really cares about, I don't think, and so everybody will be looking for the names. And most of the candidates, especially those well-known, will be campaigning, saying, you know, I'm the best candidate, vote for me on card three,
card four,
so that their people will know where to look for them.
So you're not expecting major backups of even days, it's been predicted in some places, to get this vote done?
No, I don't think so. If you haven't decided yet whether to recall the governor and you haven't decided who you're going to vote for, then you're going to have a problem. Some people like to go through and say, okay, let me see the candidates who are available. If you do that, it will take days. But I'm pretty sure people are going to go to the polls saying, I'm going to vote for whoever, and I know he's in there somewhere, and I'm going to find him.
Now, in your county in Ventura, do you have punch card ballots?
We have a punch card ballot, But we have a machine, a lever-action machine, that the voter uses to punch out the hole. So there's no question about hanging Chad. Ah. Ours has a clean, neat hole in it. The candidate's name is printed on the ballot.
Ah.
On that other system, you have a blank card. You put it into a machine, then it lists these people. You know, the famous butterfly ballot?
Yes.
You punch next to it. And when you take that card out, you don't know who in the world you voted for. And ours, you always know who you voted for. So there's no problem with our system. That's why it was not decertified as the Vote-O-Matic was.
From where you sit, what do you think is going to be the biggest problem on Election Day?
Getting the ballots ready to be there on Election Day. We normally have 30 days more to get everything done. For instance, overseas voters who have delivery problems are supposed to be mailed their ballot on the 60th day. The 60th day is come and gone. We don't even have a list of candidates, let alone a ballot.
Uh-huh.
We're supposed to have absentee ballots ready on September 8th. September 8th is just around the corner, and we don't have a list of candidates even. So we'll be open on Election Day. Whether we have the ballots there for people to vote is going to be up to the printing establishment of this state. The problem is going to be that you can't print all 58 counties at the same time. Our printer, we've made arrangements with quite far in advance. We're going to be the first one to print. So we will have our ballots. People going to the polls here will not notice anything different, except they've got a lot of cards to look through, and it's going to be an odd time to be voting.
Bruce Bradley, thanks very much for joining us.
Sure.
Bruce Bradley is Assistant Registrar for Ventura County. He spoke to us from Ventura, California.
It's Here and Now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
To millions of jazz and folk lovers for nearly 50 years now, the name Newport, as in Newport, Rhode Island, is simply magic. Where musicians from all over the world have played as sailboats glide gently by and fans soak up the sun, and where musical history's been made again and again. More on that in a moment, but first, these sounds from this year's JVC Newport Jazz Festival, which took place just this past weekend.
The performance you're about to hear, of course, this gentleman needs no introduction. He's a jazz legend. Ladies and gentlemen, Dave Brubeck and the Dave Brubeck Quartet.
Somebody told me I played the festival more than anybody else.
Why do you keep on coming back? What is it about Newport that you love so much?
Well, it's just great. You know, today was the most attentive audience I've seen in this venue. They were really listening to everybody. And they weren't dancing and partying as much as I've seen, but they were a sharp listening audience, and that's wonderful.
Please welcome Grammy Award winner and Blue Note recording artist Cassandra Wilson.
The ocean behind them and the boats and the atmosphere is just one it's so carefree, I guess. It's very laid back, very relaxed.
Do you feel the ghosts of Ella Fitzgerald, of Sarah Vaughan when you're up on stage?
Yes, there are times when I do feel that. Today was a little unusual. I think I'm not accustomed to working so early in the program. So there's a certain kind of ambiance that you get later towards the evening. You know, I do prefer that twilight time, that time between evening, afternoon and evening, you know, going into the night. And you can sense that. You can sense the history.
My name is Eddie Palmieri, and I'm an orchestra, dance orchestra leader that loves variations and extensions. Newport Jazz Festival happens to be unique. You know, it's the first one that has the most amazing history, in my opinion. Started, I believe, in 54. And the artists that have been here playing on these bandstands are the highest degree of excellence in the jazz world. And we're quite honored to be here and to be invited for the first time. On a beautiful day like today, I had a wonderful, wonderful time.
Sounds from this year's JVC Newport Jazz Festival. And as musician Eddie Palmieri just said, the Newport Jazz Fest, as well as its sister festival, the Newport Folk Fest, are both rich in history. Some of it's well known. Think Bob Dylan Goes Electric in 1965. And some not so well known. Did you know that one of the most poorly attended Newport Folk Festivals was in 1969? But on that bill were three then relatively unknown artists. A certain James Taylor.
There's something in the way she moves, or looks my way, or calls my name.
And Joni Mitchell.
I could drink a case of you.
And Van Morrison.
As we sail into the mystic.
Well, recollections like that just make you wish you'd been there. As well as insights like what really happened the night Dylan went electric, are retold by George Wine in his autobiography, Myself Among Others, A Life in Music, the man behind the Newport Jazz and Folk Festivals. Recently, George spoke to Here and Now producer April Peavy about the rich history of both the Newport Jazz and Folk Festivals and about who else made it possible for just one word, Newport, to mean so much to music.
I've always needed help in everything I've done. I've never been afraid to ask for help. I didn't know Joni Mitchell, but Judy Collins knew Judy Mitchell, but I knew Judy Collins. And I didn't know James Taylor, but there was a young lady who said to me, you have to hear this young man. And we had a board that listened to him. Next thing we know, James Taylor was on the festival. So, I mean, that was my ability to listen to people and keep an open ear for different things.
If you could see me now, you'd know how blue I've been.
You say that one of the most difficult artists you ever had to work with was Sarah Vaughan. Tell me a little bit about Sarah Vaughan.
She had a technique and a sound that nobody could equal. And she was a great artist, and it was a privilege to work with her, but she was very difficult. I tell a story about how I wanted to manage her once, but she said, how can you manage me when you're going with that girl up in Boston? This is the girl I eventually married, Joyce. And that was Sarah's problem. She never allowed somebody, she never had faith in anybody to work with her that wasn't on a personal basis that she could control personally. And she never trusted the people she should trust. And as a result, she had a rather sad life and never reached the potential she should. She was a big star. But Ella Fitzgerald went beyond that because she trusted Norman Granz. And Norman Granz put her to another level. Sarah could have reached a level like that. She never did.
The way I feel for you, I never could disguise. The look of love is written plain. I think you'd be mine again if you could see me now.
I'd like to just say four words and have you tell me about this event. Bob Dylan, electric guitar.
It seems that this is one of the most important events in musical history. My involvement was very small, except that I was there when Dylan finished his electronic set, and the people were booing and there were problems. And I said to Bob, you have to go back, there'll be a riot. He says, I can't go back, I don't have a guitar. So I said, does anybody have a guitar? And about 40 guitars were held up immediately. Peter Yarrow gave Bob a guitar to go back.
How does it feel?
Is there an artist that you miss?
Oh, I miss so many artists. I can't begin to describe when I hear records of the artists that I've worked with. Whether it's Miles or Dizzy or Duke or Louis or Ella or Sarah or Billie Holiday. I mean, I could name 50 artists that I miss. Sidney Bechet. I mean, I could go on and on and on. And I guess it's the love of those people and hoping maybe new people will come along to be their equal that keeps me going.
George Wine, the man who started the Newport Jazz and Folk Festival, speaking to Here and Now producer April Peavy.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Join us next time for the news and these stories, Here and Now.
We'll have an update from Iraq.
These stories, Here and Now.
We'll have an update from Iraq.